My name is Ann, and I'm an alcoholic. Could we have a moment of silence in gratitude for the AA recoveries for the past 75 years? So I have my speakers, and I will tell you just a tiny bit about myself. My sobriety date is January 5th, 1975. My home group is Spirited Women in Tempe, Arizona. And I'm glad they asked me to chair this meeting instead of speak, because there aren't enough of you here to give my humility talk. I'll introduce our first speaker, Josh.
I'm Josh Kahn. I'm an alcoholic, and I've been sober by the grace of God, strong sponsorship, and having had worked these steps since January 9th of 1995. And I tell you, it's definitely an honor to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous. It's an honor to be here with you guys. This is my third international convention. I just absolutely couldn't imagine missing one of these if I had the opportunity. I'm from Dallas, Texas. From the Chicago group in Dallas, Texas. It's a long story, but I'll talk about that later. My Chicago group people are here. Yeah, they are. We are an active group of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is very difficult to vary from the 12th step in my group because you're going to get called out. I mean, that's just the way it is. It's a very very energetic group of people. It's an active crowd, and I'm honored to call myself a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and honored to call myself a member of that group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My commitment at the group is I'm the trash guy on Wednesday nights. I haven't come very far. My very first commitment in Alcoholics Anonymous was the trash guy on Thursday night. Now I'm the trash guy on Wednesday night. You know, I thought there was a spirit of rotation in Alcoholics Anonymous. Apparently, it doesn't occur when you're the trash guy. When I was first made the trash guy at the group that I call my home group on Wednesday nights, I questioned the secretary of the group as to why he thought that I was uniquely situated for that position. And he said, "Josh, you're the trash guy. It's your job to take out the trash." And I said, "Well, there's a lot of things I'm capable of doing, and I'd like to share that with you." And he said, "Josh, just be here every Wednesday night, take out the trash. That's what we need you to do. Take out the trash every Wednesday night." And he said that to me very clearly. And it had been several weeks that I was doing a pretty good job of taking out the trash. And one Wednesday night, I had something going on, and I decided not to go to the group. And I just figured, you know, it's the trash. Somebody will get it taken out. And when I showed up the next Wednesday night for my home group meeting, that secretary came up to me and he said, "Josh, you weren't here to take out the trash." I said, "Did you all have trouble getting that done without me?" And he said, "No, we didn't. But let me explain to you the concept of commitment, and here's how it works." And I was shared with at that moment in a way that I didn't understand, because I thought I was so capable of so many things. Now, granted, I had drunk myself running Alcoholics Anonymous, but I thought that I was capable of a lot of things. And what was explained to me at that time was the meaning of a commitment, and the meaning of a commitment to a home group, and the meaning of doing what I say I would do when I said I would do it. And it was also explained to me that if I wasn't capable of doing it on something as trite as taking out the trash on Wednesday nights, I didn't stand much of a chance at very many other areas of my life. Because I was blessed at that point to be married. Now I'm still married. My wife Charlotte's here. You know, we've been married now 20 years, and it's just, that's a gift of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I wouldn't be capable of keeping my commitments in my house. I wouldn't be capable of keeping commitments in a job or really any other place if I couldn't do something as simple as that. So here 15 years later, I've had the privilege of doing many, many things in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm just honored to be the trash guy on Wednesday night. And that really brings me to what I'm here to talk about, step 12. I sponsor men in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is an absolute honor and privilege. And I don't think that there's any greater opportunity to act as a leader in Alcoholics Anonymous than as a sponsor. It's a tremendous obligation. It is the one area where I can't make it up on the fly. You know, I can make it up on the fly pretty well at work, because if something goes bad, it's money. You know, if I mess up, it'll work out. Somebody else is going to be there to kind of pick up after me. You know, or I may get fired. You know, I mean, lots of things can happen. But the consequences are not as dire as when we're talking about a man's life. And this is a life and death thing that we're talking about here. And so what is it about the 12th step that makes this such an amazing obligation? When I take out the trash on Wednesday nights, when I am, you know, responsible at my home group for cleaning up, I talk to the men that I sponsor, and they're picking up cups. And they're serving as examples to other men around them. And I just hope that 15 years from now, those guys are standing there with their guys picking up cups. Because it's something as simple as that that's been able to keep me sober these many years. Now, certainly, all the rest of the steps, I had to work all the rest of the steps to find all the other things that are going on in my life. But what now? You know, why am I here this many years later? What now? I had to admit that I was powerless over alcohol. You know, it didn't take much to admit that my life was unmanageable. I had a good sponsor, and he pointed it out to me on a daily basis. My life was unmanageable by me. I came to find, through my sponsor's guidance and direction, a group of men at Dickie's Barbecue on Knox Street that was going to the traditional group. And that group of men would go to Dickie's Barbecue and have dinner and then go on over to the meeting. And my sponsor brought me to that meeting. And I'd sit there with those guys, and I always had that look, you know, just that look of the new man. Just miserable. And those guys would say, "Josh, how's it going?" I said, "Oh, not so good. You know, my wife, you don't understand, guys, my wife, this is what happened." And I'd lay it out for them. And those guys would share with me their experience. They'd say, "You know, that used to be what would happen to us too. You know, our wives used to talk to us the way your wife talks to you, and here's what we did about it." And they started sharing their experience with me. And I came to understand through that experience at Dickie's Barbecue from that group of men, it was a brain trust like I'd never met before in my entire life. They were solving problems in my life like nothing had ever been solved. And that group of men came for me the power greater. That was my second step right there, that group of men. And I trusted that group of men. And one day, I brought them something that was a little tricky. And I thought, you know, these guys will figure it out. They're pretty good at getting me out of scrapes. And one of these old guys started laughing. And I said, "Well, what's so funny?" He said, "Well, Josh, what's so funny is you're totally screwed." And I said, "That's not funny." He pointed out to me the line in We Agnostics, and I'm going to paraphrase this. If I get it wrong, don't crucify me on it. But it says, "Crushed by a self-imposed crisis, we could not postpone or evade. We had to fearlessly face the fact that God is everything or else he is nothing." And I said, what are you talking about? He said, "Well, you created this mess. It is self-imposed, and it sounds like you're crushed, and what are you going to do about it?" I said, "Well, what am I going to do about it? You guys are the brain trust." He said, "Got nothing. I got nothing. All I got for you is pray about it." And I had to walk outside, and my sponsor at the time was extraordinarily good with me. He let me rattle on. And I said, "I just don't know what to do." And he said, "What you do, Josh, is you go ask God for help. You ask God for help." And I said, "Man, you and I have talked about this. I don't necessarily have a relationship with God. I don't know if I believe or don't believe, but it's just not my deal." He said, "You know, that's fine. You can suffer and die, or you can choose to try this." And I had to admit to him that I didn't know how to pray. And he said, "Just ask God for help the same way you asked me." And this man was giving me the best that could be given at that moment. He was there for me in a way that I just couldn't even imagine. And I went home, and I went in the bathroom because I didn't want my wife to see me praying. And I got down on my knees, and I said, "God, if you're there, whatever you are, I got this problem. Don't really know what to do about it. Can you please help me? I'm alone here." And I got up, and the toilet didn't flush and the lights didn't blink, and I thought it was a ripoff. I tell you, just like that, I thought the whole thing was a ripoff. But within 24 hours, this idea popped into my head out of nowhere. And it was a pretty good idea. And I did it. And the whole situation kind of righted itself. It all worked out. And I called that sponsor of mine on the phone. And this is where good sponsorship really kicks in. I said, Greg, this idea popped into my head. And I shared it with him. He's like, man, that's a pretty good idea. I said, well, do you think that was my subconscious working that out when I was just letting it unfold? Or, you know, what was that? He goes, Josh, clearly that did not come from you because you were not that smart. He said, you did what we do and you got what we get. And on that moment, the God idea came true for me. On that moment. And so I went on and I worked the fourth step and I worked the fifth step and came to get a greater understanding of steps 6 and 7 through working steps 8 and 9. And on a daily basis, I have the opportunity to straighten out all the mess of my life with steps 10 and 11. And so here I am. Here I am. You know, God didn't bring me here to drop me in Alcoholics Anonymous and be a sober guy. God brought me here to be the husband and father and employee and son that I'm supposed to be. He brought me to this place so that I can give back to the world the gift that He wants me to give. I am in the world to play the role that God assigns me. I am now on I'm on borrowed time. You know, I used up all the me time. You know, I just burned it up. You know, I wish I hadn't. I wish I could have had a little bit of that back. But, you know, I burned up all the selfish time. And so now when I wake up in the morning, you know, because God has an amazing sense of humor, you know, my wife and I were married for 20 years. We have a 17-year-old son who was a year and a half old when I got sober. You know, that's a sobering experience. It's another very long story. But he was a year and a half old when I got sober. Right when I got sober, coincidentally, we started to sleep together again, and we had another child. So now we have a 14-year-old son, and through a tremendous series of mistakes and misunderstandings, we now have a 3.5-year-old daughter and a 1-year-old son. It's crazy, and I'll tell you that in my house, when I wake up in the morning, the me time's over. You know, maybe 20 years from now, you know, who knows? I'll be that guy who'll break out the smoking jacket and the slippers, right? But for now, my time is committed to others. My time is committed to either, you know, wiping noses, you know, disciplining kids for smoking, changing diapers, going to work to pay for all this mess. Thank God I'm employed. And, you know, thanks to a very loving and tolerant mother, I work with my mother. Don't recommend that to the new man. I am a blessed man by any measure. I get to do a lot of things that were not in my set of cards when I got here. So what does all this mean? I want to close with one thing. I'm a reader and I can tell you many of the men I sponsor in the room, my sponsor is in the room, and my grand sponsor is very fond of talking about a topic that Bill W. brought to the grapevine in 1959 about leadership. And I understand today the role of leadership in Alcoholics Anonymous at a greater level than I ever have. I made a tremendous error. This is an opportunity to talk about it from my sponsor, I guess. I made a tremendous error a number of years ago. We started a book study, and when we started that book study, I thought I was too busy to really be a part of that at any level. I wanted to just kind of show up and study the book and then go back home to my house. And so we allowed, isn't it funny how that works out? It's nothing happens by mistake, but another member of the group became the secretary of a group that basically I started. It was kind of an interesting thing. Me and another gentleman started the group, but then this third person became the secretary, and it was kind of a train wreck. And the train was way off the rails. And every time I'd talk to my sponsor about why that group was going funny, he'd say, you don't think you have a hand in this? You were supposed to be the secretary. And I don't want to hear about it. And so now, I guess about 4 secretaries later, it's finally come around to me, and I'm the secretary of the group. And I understand, and it's a book study, right? It's one book study in a city with hundreds of meetings every week. It's one meeting a week. But I understand my role at that group. I'm the secretary of that group. It's my job to get there and make sure the coffee is ready, the signs are out, that if we meet in a church, that the cigarette butts don't get strung around because we don't want this church thinking badly of Alcoholics Anonymous. We want to be a good example to that church. That the book is read. No other topic. We read the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous at that meeting, and we start on time, we end on time, and we clean up after ourselves. We lock the door and we stand outside and have the real meeting, which is one alcoholic talking to another after that meeting. But as a leader at that group, you know, it really brings me to the role. You know, there is a limited amount of organization here in Alcoholics Anonymous, but that doesn't mean that there's a lack of leadership. It doesn't mean that. And I know that leadership starts in my home group, and with me, my greatest responsibility is to serve as a leader of the men that I sponsor. And so I want to read this. This is from Bill W. from the Grapevine in 1959. That was 7 years before I was born. Think about the power of that. You know, we're standing here at the 75th anniversary. 7 years before I was born, Bill wrote something that means something to me today. It says, every sponsor is necessarily a leader. The stakes are huge. A human life and usually the happiness of a whole family hangs in the balance. What the sponsor does and says, how well he estimates the reactions of his prospects, how well he times and makes his presentation, how well he handles criticisms, and how well he leads his prospect on by personal, spiritual example. Well, these attributes of leadership can make all the difference, often the difference between life and death. And so I thank you guys. I thank Alcoholics Anonymous for the life that I have, and I realize that my role is to give it back every day. That's all I got.
Thank you. You ended 4 minutes early.
Oh, that's good. You can
have one. Okay. Our next speaker is Myra.
Thank you, Ann. Hi, my name is Myra, and I am an alcoholic. Hi, everybody, and thank you, Josh. It is very, very overwhelming to be here, especially since my sponsor is here. She lives in a different city, and I don't always get to speak with her here. And my sober sisters are here, and my sponsee is here, and some of her sponsees are here. And boy, do we have an amazing family. My home group is the Atlantic Group in New York City. I think it is the most enthusiastic home group on the planet. And my sobriety date is January 24th, 1986. I will tell you my truth about international conventions. I think if the Beatles were alive and they were performing, I would not go through what I went through last night to see them. I would not go through what I went through last night, but what I did go through last night was indescribable, and it was so worth it, because it cannot be described in words. It is like that there is a solution in the Big Book that normally we would not mix, but there exists among us this camaraderie, because we share two things, common peril and common solution, and it is palpable. I could feel it. Even waiting, was it 3 hours we waited? Went by fast because of the energy and what was in that room, the gratitude, the light of people that were lost and now they are found. And maybe even some of them are awakened. And, you know, along that lines of the 12th step. Thank you, Josh, because I want to quickly go through. I think the step has three parts to it. It is, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, carrying the message, and then practicing these principles in all our affairs. And so real quickly to kind of speed dial my experience with the steps. I agree with what Bill says, is that the only one we really have to work perfectly is the first one. And I am so blessed and so grateful to have had what I believe was a perfect first step experience. I wound up on January 24th, 1986, in Georgia Mental Health Institute. I was living in New York. One of my brothers, I have three, my brother Jerry intervened and got me this place, this bed in Georgia Mental Health Institute. And, you know, I checked in there belligerent. I didn't think I had anything was wrong with me. I thought you people were insane, but I was not insane. The problem was I had a physical problem. I just couldn't quit a day without a drink. So maybe I would kind of stick around here and I would see what was up. I didn't share anybody, you know, my plan, which was just to kind of detox for the 28 days or whatever it was, and then get some money from my brother Jerry, and then return to what I was doing in New York, which was never leaving my apartment and doing nothing. And that was my plan as Myra saw it. And there was a counselor there, and her name was Cindy, and she had my number, one alcoholic helping another. She had a year, and I knew she knew. And now she said a couple of things to me, but one of the things she said to me was, "Is your brother your back door, Myra?" And when she said that, I knew I loved my brother. And I knew I was going to go back, but I knew if I went back, I was going to die. And in that split second, I had this shift that I wanted to live. And I surrendered. I had a palatable surrender. I admitted complete defeat, and the weight of the world was lifted from my shoulders. And I felt a relief that I cannot describe, but it was just sort of described in a spiritual experience. I had a spiritual experience. And I shifted from being belligerent to, "I know what I'm doing," to, "Tell me what to do." And there I was in the archway of the second step, as I came to at that rehab. The second and third step to me are very, very different at this point in my sobriety than they were when I first came in. But I have an example that kind of illustrates my second and third step experience. When I decided, okay, I was going to take guidance and direction and stay in Atlanta, because you said stay away from your playmates and your playgrounds, and I was going to get a good foundation, and I wound up going to what I called feeling school, because the principle behind the first step is honesty. I wasn't constitutionally capable of being honest with myself. I was befogged. I needed to go where a place where I could get in touch and tell you what I felt, because I thought numb was a feeling. So I stayed there until I left that rehab, and I remember staying in Atlanta, and my friend Bruce, who I'll get to later, my friend Bruce gave me a place to stay, and I didn't think I could have survived. I don't know what would have happened to me if he didn't give me a place to stay. So now I'm going to grace Atlanta with my presence, and I'm going to look for a temporary job. And I'm going to need a car. You know, I was living in New York. I didn't have a car. And Bruce, who it turned out had 2 weeks more sobriety than I did, he had a sponsor. Now, I had a sponsor, too, but his sponsor actually had a car. And he gave me, for $100, a 69 Dodge Dart called Sarge. So I was happening. I'm the queen of gratitude, by the way, when I surrendered and felt that relief. And it was the same. It was relief like I felt the first time I had a drink. You know, I felt relief the first time I had a drink, because suddenly I felt like I could connect. I could not connect. I had dark thoughts before that. The God that I came here with, I thought, hated me, wanted me miserable, and was out to kill me. So now the Queen of Gratitude, it's the first day at this temporary job, driving this 69 Dodge Dart called Sarge on my way back from my job. The car breaks down. Oh, my God, it's the end of the world as I know it. You people are just like everybody else. Bruce's sponsor ripped me off. He sold me a lemon, and now I have a choice, and that choice is death. And I'm going to kill myself, and I'm going to jump. Now, forget that it was 2 blocks from where Bruce lived. I'm gonna jump in front of a car and kill myself. And all of a sudden, this little voice came over me, and the voice said, "Call your sponsor." Now, I'd never had a choice like that. I'd only had a choice of death, drugs and alcohol. All of a sudden, this is a voice. I got to the phone. I called my sponsor. The minute she answered the phone, I was restored to sanity, and I knew I did not have to kill myself. And what the third step is about to me is positive action. That's what my sponsor taught me. It's not just a decision, it's affirmative action. So what that meant was like calling AAA and getting help. So what I'm here to tell you today, that what was wrong with that car was that it was out of gas. So don't quit 5 minutes for the miracle if you're new. All right, now step four. It wasn't until I got a sponsor that I really wanted what she had, and that is my sponsor today, Francine W., who took me through the steps as they are outlined in our literature. Because I did the first time I did it by the Hazel and God. I was just looking for an easier, softer way. I didn't even get 8 and 9 because I never did the list. So when I heard somebody say, you know, the fourth step is like a cookbook. You do it line by line. You don't leave anything out. So I did my fourth step like that. I did my fifth step with Francine, and we are still in a step study. We're still doing the steps. In fact, I'm more open and now comprehending them on such a different level. And what the fifth step is to me is about today is about really knowing who I am. When I first came in, it was such not an overnight process for me. But the fifth step today is, you know, without this fifth step, I am capable of looking at my best friend and seeing her faults and not knowing they're the very ones that I also emulate. And that is the power of this fifth step. When I was doing the steps the first time with Francine, I remember going in a meeting and hearing somebody say, the purpose of 6 and 7 is to get me out of the picture so I can do 8 and 9. I love that. That really helped me because I had done 8 and 9 at other times expecting an amends back. That's not the way that works. But what I find today with 6 and 7 is that if I really comprehend these steps, once I'm current with my 8 and 9, I don't have to do any more 8 and 9s, that I can actually live without having to do them. Not that I don't still have to do them. They're definitely, it's again, this isn't the steps. None of them can work or have worked perfectly, except hopefully that first one. Now with 8 and 9, I harmed anybody. I didn't think anybody really cared about me. But with Francine, I made the list, and I got the list from my resentments on the fourth step, which I resented anybody that I ever knew, basically. And I learned with 8 was that willingness. And even though I didn't understand it, even though I went forward with 9 and I got that willingness. And it was in the 9th step that really and truly I had my awakening. It's indescribable until you kind of face your fellows. It's the beginning and the end of the end between isolation and man and God. And until I experienced it, again, it's like, how can we describe what happened last night? Had to be there. And it's the same thing with experiencing the 9th step. And with my brother, I remember I didn't really understand why I had to pay him back because he paid for my rehab because he had like a zillion times more money than I did. And he said I didn't have to, but you people had guided me in your experience. We do the right thing. And I remember when I did become willing and I did make the amends to him and I gave him what I could pay, and I did it in quarterly payments like taxes, which I pay as well. And he told me, he said, you know what? You take this money, and I want you to give it to this woman that worked for my family for 40 years named Bertha. She was our nursing. So I took this check to Bertha. And again, I had come from, I am deprived, the world owes me. I am entitled. And all of a sudden, I'm giving money that I don't think I have, and I'm giving this money to Bertha. And it turned out her granddaughter had been murdered, and she couldn't pay for the funeral. So here I am giving her a check to pay for the funeral. And at that point, I felt a wealth that is indescribable. I felt an abundance that is indescribable by giving somebody money. And that's what Bill says, expect the unexpected. Well, the 10th step, boy, what a freedom that step is to me. If I am not the problem, there is not a solution. And if I'm pointing my finger at you, there's more fingers pointed right back at me. This really helps me own my part and not come from the intoxicating defect of blame. I do not have to go there. And if I do, I don't go there very long. I don't stay there. The 11th step to me completely changed a few years ago when I started to meditate on a daily basis. The God that I found here is an awesome, loving God. I learned prayer right away, but meditation has definitely enhanced the quality of my sobriety. It has given me an intuition. It has given me a conscious contact that, again, is something that I cannot describe. However, That alone, maybe with a conscious contact, I can get inspired. Maybe I can write a draft of a novel. But it is in the 12th step that is the theme of joy of living. Now, I can have fun, and I can laugh, and I can have much happiness in sobriety, but it's the joy of living that is the theme of this step. It is love and service that is the principle. It is having that service mentality that is the freedom that knows that I have never experienced. It is the giving freely that I never knew how to give freely. I would give you the shirt off my back when I was drinking, but I had expectations. You were supposed to then, you know, take me to Spain or whatever. You know, I never knew how to give freely. And I have had lots of experiences on the 12th step, I am happy to say. There's a lot of people here from the Pacific Palisades. When I lived there, I had this great home group. And one of the organized services we did was we'd go to a hospital in East L.A. And we would actually go to the beds of suffering alcoholics, go to their bed like Bill and Bob did. And I remember one night going to this guy who was obviously hallucinating and had DTs, and he said, "Look at that cat." And I remember going home that night, and I had my cat Howard then, and hugging my cat Howard because I was in reality. And I was so grateful to be in reality and that my reality was friendly. Now, I've also seen a lot of people that did not make it in this fellowship and in this program. And this step is for people who want it and are willing to go to any length like I do, as that's where we get the joy of living from this 12th step. And about 10 years into my sobriety, Bruce decided he wanted to go another way, and he quit going to meetings. He was my brother's best friend. I loved him. I loved him unconditionally, and he was still in my life. And I did not let go of him. And I remember him, the last time I saw him, he came to my apartment in New York to introduce me to this wonderful new girlfriend he had. And he was decided to pursue this indigenous drug called ayahuasca. And that was his choice, and that was his path. Bruce was like a brother to me. He was one of the nicest, kindest men I ever knew, but he had enormous success in sobriety. And he went this other path. The last time I talked to him, I could tell something was really wrong with Bruce. And I said, "Bruce, are you using?" And he said, "No." And I hung up the phone, and my gut was like, why didn't I say something else? Why didn't I say, "Put your girlfriend on the phone and let me talk to her"? Instead, I called a mutual friend who is not in this fellowship, but he told me that he was getting him help, that he was going to see a psychiatrist. A month later, I got the call, that Bruce had overdosed and was on life support in a hospital in Charleston. So I got to go down there, and I got to see my friend on life support, and I got to see my friend who was 46 years old, who his hair wasn't even gray, and I said my goodbye to Bruce. Now, Bruce got sober because his only other sibling had overdosed 3 years before that. The first time he ever tried heroin, he overdosed and died on it. And Bruce's mother, again, this is how love and service comes in. It may not be who we think it is. She came up to me and she said, "Was it my fault? Could I have done any? What should I not have gotten married?" You know, she looked at me. She had lost both of her children. She never had grandchildren to this disease. What could she have done? And I was able to tell her that probably no human power can relieve our alcoholism, and that Bruce, if he wanted it, he had a choice. He could have called me instead of calling the other person who he told that he didn't want to go out with us people and drink coffee. And again, that was his choice. But I can be of love and service to his mother. I call her on Mother's Day. I call and I talk to her because, like I said, Bruce was like a brother to me. And then I have another kind of really cool story because he's here today, my friend David. And I worked with David in New York, and professionally I worked with David, and he had this amazing, glamorous life. And he traveled all around the world. But I knew something was kind of up with David. And I didn't have that many people in my sphere that were obviously using. But in his case, he was. And I wrote my anonymity to him, and I tried to attract him, but I was there for him. And one day I got what I thought was the call, and David had lost everything. He had lost his apartment. He'd lost his job. He had no money. He was on a Greyhound bus going to live with his parents in Houston, Texas. So I said to him, "Ready, David? I will get you the number of some men in AA in Houston. Are you ready? I'll go get those numbers for you." And he goes, "Oh, Myra, it's not that bad." I said, "David, you're on a Greyhound bus with no money. You've been first class going to Australia." He wasn't ready. But the good news is, a couple of years later, he said I was the first person he called when he did hit his bottom. For David, it took going to jail. For other people, some of us, it doesn't have to. But for David, it did. And he's at his very first convention. He just celebrated a year now. And so I'm so... So David is a part of me. How's my time? Okay, I got the... I want to, again, thank you all for helping me to stay sober today. It's an honor and a privilege. Thank you, Myra. Okay, our next speaker is David.
Move this water before I spill it. My name's David Schaffner. I'm an alcoholic. Hello, everybody. It's good to be here with you. Man, I'm nervous. My sobriety date is January 27th, 1987. My sponsor's name is Andy A. My home group is the Savannah Group. We meet in Savannah, Georgia, every Monday and Thursday night at 8 o'clock. If you're ever in Savannah, we invite you to please come and join us. If you don't want to come see us, come see any meeting in Savannah. It's all good AA. Please come visit us. Before I get talking on my 12-step experience, I want to extend some gratitude to my delegate who submitted my name as a possible presenter during the international. What a great honor it is to be a part of it. But I do know that she only presented the name. I got a letter from Rick up at the GSO asking me to participate, and I know he had a small part. So whoever is on the committee and wherever you may be, thank you very much for the opportunity. Sharing with you my 12-step experience, or my experience with the 12-step, I want to do it in two different directions. First, I want to kind of tell you how the message was carried to me, how folks got me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and then as I kind of move along, kind of tell you how I might have grown just a little bit with that, and then in the end, what I try to do today. My sobriety began right here in San Antonio. For me, this is a homecoming. January 26th of 1987, my wife came home from her job at the local Stop and Rob and found me sitting on the front step of our porch with my face in my hands, and I was absolutely distraught. And yes, I was drunk. And she looked at me and she asked me a few questions, and I told her a few things that kind of scared her. And to sum up what happened over the next 2 days, 2 days later, found me sitting in my commander's office. I sobered up on active duty. And 2 days, after 2 days without drinking, I was sitting in my commander's office, and my commander looked at me and he said, "David, what's the problem?" Now, I didn't believe I was an alcoholic. I didn't believe I drank too much, but I knew I had to tell him something. And I had some other things going on that I didn't really want to talk about, so I looked at him and I said, "Well, I think I might drink too much." See, I knew the military had a plan to take care of that if I could just get him to focus on something other than what I really wanted to needed to focus on, probably. So he said, "Yeah, we can fix that. Come on." So a little while later, we wound up in the Social Actions Building on the old side of Lackland Air Force Base. And they introduced me to a guy named Jerry P., who was a counselor at Social Actions. And at the time, Jerry was 18 years sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. And I sat across from him in his office that morning at his desk, and he 12-stepped me. I didn't know that's what he was doing, but he told me his story. And as he told me his story, I sat across from him and I thought, "You're sick." you need help. And as soon as I get things situated with myself, we'll work on you. But in the meantime, don't tell anybody else that story. So he finished his story and he told me a little bit about Al-Anon. And when he got done, he invited me to an AA meeting. And when the military invites you to do something, you accept because you're going. So at the end of it, like I said, he told me about Al-Anon. So I go home and I tell my bride, you're sick. We need to go to meetings. She says, okay. So in 2 days, I get introduced to Jerry. On my third day without a drink, I go to my first AA meeting. My first AA meeting, I hear a woman, a housewife, Nancy B. She spoke, and I heard a guy, a carpenter, John K. He spoke. They told their story, and I've never been skilled enough to be a carpenter, and I ain't never really going to be a housewife. But that night, I got very lucky because I was trying to figure out how to fit in. And that night, I kept looking for the ways that I fit in because I knew the Air Force wanted me to be successful. And I wanted to be successful in what I was doing because if I did, that meant I was okay. They'd leave me alone. But that night, I got very lucky and I identified with both of those guys. At 5 days sober, I go to a meeting over at the Winners Club. And I sit at the meeting and, of course, they figured out I was a newcomer. The meeting got over, and some guy named Mike S. came wandering up to me, and he said, David, do you have a sponsor? And I said, no, what's that? So he went over and he got me the pamphlet, Questions and Answers on Sponsorship. He said, well, I'm not really sure exactly what he said. What I heard him say was, if you'll take this pamphlet home and read it, you'll be an expert on sponsorship. Now, I don't know about you, but I really like being an expert, especially in those days. So I go home and I read the pamphlet twice because I don't want to miss nothing. I come back the next morning for the men's meeting over at the Women's Club. And I get there early because I'm looking for my sponsor because I've read the pamphlet. I realize it's important. And I look around the room and I realize, oh, that guy over there. Look at those pants and that shirt. Can't believe he wore that. He won't do. That guy over there. Oh, my God. He's got, what, 4 teeth in his whole head. He'll never, you know. That guy over there, that cat, he ain't never seen a toothbrush or a comb. Nobody qualified for such an important job as to be my sponsor. So the meeting began and I sat down and Mike S. was chairing the meeting that morning. He brought up the topic of sponsorship. And about partway through the meeting, he called on me, which was very appropriate since he knew I was now a qualified expert on the topic. And he asked me to share, and I said, my name is David. I'm an alcoholic. I don't have a sponsor. I'm looking for a sponsor. Thank you very much. That's the shortest I've ever shared in an AA meeting to date. So the meeting got over, and this guy came walking over to me, and he stuck his hand out. He said, hey, David, my name's Jack. I'm from Houston. He said, this is Doug. He's from Houston. He was real proud of Houston, I could tell. He said, I'm Doug's sponsor. Doug just moved here from Houston. He needs to be a sponsor. You need a sponsor. Y'all get together. And he turned around and he walked off. And I thought, I've read the pamphlet. The pamphlet don't say nothing about Jack from Houston. I don't know Doug. I've never seen Doug. I didn't particularly care for what Doug shared in the meeting. But Doug is about 6'4", 240 pounds. I'm not telling Doug no. Doug became my sponsor. And that's exactly what I needed. That began. And I went on to treatment at Wilford Hall Medical Center and I graduated with honors. Any other honor graduates in the room? So I leave that and I join the AA community of San Antonio. And around 5 or 6 months sober, I begin reading some of our literature. And I read Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers and AA Comes of Age. And I read all the 12-step work that they did. And I really wanted to be a part of that. A big book told me that I had the unique ability to touch another suffering drunk or another alcoholic. And I wanted to be able to experience what they talked about. And I paid attention in meetings at that time as 12-step calls that were coming in the room. And as they came into the room, I'd go up and I'd check up on them. One came into the room that night, about 8:15 on a Friday or Saturday night. at an 8:15 meeting toward the end of the meeting. I went up and I checked on it. Who's the 12-step call for? Is anybody willing to go? And there were a bunch of people that checked up on it. And as they checked and they saw the name, they said, no, don't want to do that. But I said, I'd like to do it. And a lady named Connie S. said, I'll go with you, David. And I wanted to go because I wanted to tag along. I wanted to see just how you did this. So Connie says, I'll go with you, David. So we jump in her car. We drive 10 minutes over to this guy named Dennis F.'s house. And we get to his house, and the front porch is completely dark. There's no lights that we can see on in the house. We step up on the porch, and we knock on the door. No answer. We knock again. No answer. We try the handle. We push the door open a little bit. And as we're pushing the door open, Dennis meets us. And he pulls the door open the rest of the way, and he invites us in. We walk down this little hallway into a kitchen, combination kitchen and dining room. And Connie looks over to the right, and the dishes in the kitchen are piled eyeball high. And she says, I'm going to do the dishes and make him something to eat. You go talk to him. What? What am I supposed to tell this guy? She said, you go in there and talk to him. You tell him why you're in AA. Tell him why you came to AA. Tell him why you stay in AA. And I thought, okay. So she goes in and does her thing, and I go in, and Dennis walks in and drops down on the floor, you know, probably his chair of choice, and leans up against a bookcase or something, and I start talking to him, telling my story. And I don't know if anything's registering with this guy, but in the middle of talking to him, I talked about the loneliness that I felt when I drank. When I mentioned the word loneliness, he just burst into tears. And he just kept crying and crying and crying. And by the time his food was brought to him, he was just sobbing constantly. We finally got him to eat a little bit, and we asked him, he said, do you want to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous? He said, yes, I do. So we snatched him up. We took him over to a 10:30 meeting, and that night he picked up a white chip. And I hung around San Antonio for another 2 or 3 months before the military had their fill of me and asked me to go back home. And the last I heard of Dennis, I kept track with a few folks in San Antonio, and the last I heard that he actually managed to pick up a 2-year chip. And today, anytime I think of that guy, I think of what small part I had to be able to be a part of that, to see that. Because what I learned from Dennis was not to give up on my fellow drunk. What I also learned was that from the other people who were not so willing to jump out on that 12-step call that day was that sometimes the best I can do is to lay the groundwork for you and to let you carry that message to that drunk. I left San Antonio and I moved back home to Savannah, Georgia. I stayed sober. Last night, Harold, during the big meeting, talked about we get a lot of transfers in our program. My wife is a transfer from the Al-Anon family groups. She came in when I was 11 months sober, and when I was about 15 or 16 months sober, I went into a dry drunk. And she didn't quite know what to do with her husband. She couldn't come talk to me about it. We'd been told, work your own program. She didn't know what to do. How do I reach David? She went to one of our old-timers. Says, my husband is just at home. You know, I don't know what's going to happen with him. He's miserable. And one of our old-timers said, you know, the 12 steps says carry this message to alcoholics. He asked her, he said, are you an alcoholic? She said, yeah. He said, is he an alcoholic? She said, yeah. He said, well, carry the message. She said, well, I can't go talk to him. You know, he'll shut me down. So he said, look, do this. I underlined on page 58 of the big book the very first sentence of how it works. First sentence is, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. He said, do that, underline it in the book, drop it in his lap, and just walk away. So she was courageous enough. She took a chance. She underlined it in the book. She dropped it in my lap while I was watching the slip of vision. And as she walked away, I looked at her and I thought, who do you think you are? You know? But I couldn't talk to her. She'd already left the room. So that night, I went back to a regular AA meeting, and it got me back on track because she was willing to take a chance. As time went along, I've managed to stay sober. I have learned in various ways how to be a leader or try to be a leader in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I was about 18 months sober, I allowed myself to be elected as a GSR. I wanted to be GSR because I knew with me running a group It would be the best group in town. Couldn't fail. You know, but if you have you ever tried to get a group of drunks to do exactly what you want them to do? To say exactly what you want them to say? To act the way you want them to act? That's hard work. And it's at that time that I began to learn how to be a leader in Alcoholics Anonymous while remaining a servant. As my sobriety has moved along, I've also learned through our service structure that I also carry the message, and sometimes the best I can do is to help create an atmosphere where 12-step work takes place. And we do that through our various service positions. I've also done that by participating with various service committees. It's through our service committees that we're able to carry the message of recovery into jails and institutions, that we're able to get the message out to professionals to let them know that Alcoholics Anonymous could be something that could be a benefit to any of their clients. And we also put the message out in the public that any alcoholic can come to AA and get help. Today in my professional life, I am an operations manager for a very small company. Most of my 12-step work today takes place as a result of my group membership, as a result of being a sponsor to a number of guys in this program, and also through the service work that I do within our service structure. But every once in a while, I'll get lucky and I'll get to do a 12-step call. Thursday, a week ago, my boss, who is also my brother, went to visit two of our newer employees on the job site. And he called me up after the visit and he said, "David, I think Susie was tipsy. What do we do? So we talked about it for a little bit. And the next morning we got together and we decided to have a meeting. And because you have taught me to stay sober and be happy about that fact, and he has seen me walk this sobriety, instead of us having a meeting where we gather together so that we could dismiss an employee that we thought was drunk on the job, he allowed me to tell her my story and to carry this message of recovery to her. So I did that. And then I put her in touch with a lady in this program. And that lady got her to her first AA meeting. And I don't know if she'll stay sober. I have absolutely no clue. But I do know this. She's been taken to a place where she knows and she understands that she doesn't have to be alone anymore. She doesn't have to live that life of misery and absolute hopelessness. There's a way out. There's a way out. I try today. I've had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, and I try to carry this message on a regular basis. As a result of having done that and trying to do that, you've introduced me to a higher power that I trust today. You've introduced me to a family that I love. And as a combination of all those things, I will tell you this. Because of that, I haven't met, seen, or heard anyone that I'd rather be today than me. And for that, I thank you and Alcoholics Anonymous.
I want to thank our speakers. They were wonderful. Josh. And Myra, and David. We have some time for questions. There is a mic in the middle aisle if some of you want to go to the mic and ask any of our speakers a question, or me. Anyone want to?
Hi, my name is Seth, and I'm an alcoholic from San Francisco, California.
Thanks,
Seth. Hi, I don't really have a question, but I just wanted to say, you know, thank you very much for what you shared. And I was just talking to a friend of mine about how he needs, like, some newcomers to work with, because being at this convention is amazing. It's my first one, you know, but sometimes it feels like, oh, congratulations, we're all sober, congratulations to ourselves, you know. And thank you so much for what you said, because it reminds me that I've got to be out there constantly available to help the still suffering alcoholic, you know, and that's even when I'm in San Antonio, Texas, far away from home, you know. And the thing, and I loved your story about going to the guy with the dishes piled up. It's like you just got to do it, you know. There's no amount of studying up on it or figuring it out first, you know. You just got to throw yourself in there and do it and take God with you, You know, and this has been the most amazing experience for me, and I'm so lucky that I get to be here today. So thank you.
Thanks, Seth. Anyone else? If not, oh, there comes someone.
Hi, I'm Stella from Phoenix. You talked about the ninth step, and how was that important, and how did that help in your 12-step work and your recovery?
I didn't get the question. I couldn't understand it.
You talked about the ninth step, and how was that in helping with your recovery?
Okay, who?
Myra. Myra did.
Hi. Thank you for the question. The ninth step was vital to my recovery because, again, it helped me awaken, and it helped me have that spiritual awakening. I was one of these people, honestly, who tried the two-step. You know, when I got the first one, and then I was ready to fix everybody in my family and every single person. You needed. I was going to 12-step everybody. But it was really the power of all the steps in between the first and the 12th that awakened me to be able to carry the message and to practice these principles in all my affairs. Because, again, that's if I'm going out of a meeting and I'm, you know, yelling at somebody on the street, I'm not carrying that message, and I'm not practicing these principles in all my affairs. So I think they're all vital, actually. So thanks.
Thank you. We have another question.
Hi, my name is Dan. I'm an alcoholic. And David, I'm from Houston, Texas. My question is, do you ever question yourself on how much of your experience that you share with a newcomer? Because sometimes I tend to get a little too deep because I have numerous years now, instead of like just trying to keep it short and sweet, you know, and present a rosy picture of us.
Thank you for your question. Do you know Jack?
No, I don't know Jack.
Okay.
That's why I'm here.
Very good. To answer your question, with me, it depends on the situation. Obviously, with the young lady that I helped 12-step call Thursday a week ago, I spent very little time. It wasn't me that she really needed to hear from. I carried her just the barest of messages, told her a little bit about the program, took her a few pamphlets. She was open. I immediately passed her off on to one of the ladies that I know. Depending on other circumstances, I've had times when I've been out on 12-step calls where I've sat for 4 hours and just talked until I was blue in the face, until the guy finally said, "Look, dude, I just wanted you to give me a ride." You know, it all depends on the circumstance as to how deep I get.
Thank you.
Thanks for your question. We have someone else going to the mic.
Hi, everybody. I'm Bill. I'm an alcoholic from Katy, Texas. Right. This is a problem I've always had a problem with, and I really struggle with in trying to do sponsorship. And it's, do I go to any length to chase the alcoholic? Anybody is welcome to answer that question.
No, I can pull a short straw on that one. Obviously not. I mean, the man's wife would want you to, I'm sure. I have found that the best question to ask a man who is standing in front of me suffering from the disease of alcoholism is, do you want an answer to your problem? And if the man says no, then why am I wasting either of our time with that conversation? Again, I go to a home group that's founded on principles, and one of the things that's nice about that is that it's self-cleansing. If a man doesn't want what we have to give away, typically they go away. And the nice thing about that is that we grab them and hug them and tell them, you know what, we're here if you ever want to come back. And what didn't work here is not the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's your efforts. You didn't do it. And then they go on their way, and sometimes they come back, and sometimes they don't. When they don't come back, they're equally a good example. So that's all I got.
Next.
Thank you all for sharing with us. My name is Bob. I'm an alcoholic. My home group is Nooners, King of Prussia, Pennsylvania. Thank you. I've done 12-step calls. I have. Last Sunday, I had 27 years. And so I've done some 12-step call. But the one that really stuck out at me is somebody asked me to go on a call. And we sat for 3 hours talking to this guy. And I said to him, you know, my problem wasn't drinking. My problem was I couldn't stop drinking. And the guy goes, oh, yeah, I understand that. So you never know which part of what you're saying to these somebody is going to work. And I was lucky. I was 12-step by somebody in another program. And the first thing the girl said to me was she was 19. She was a kid, and I didn't particularly care for her attitude. And she said to me, Bob, are you an alcoholic? And I said, no, maybe. And then she said, well, you think about going to Alcoholics Anonymous? And I said, no. Well, a few weeks later, she was smarter, and she brought her sponsor with her the next time she asked me if I was an alcoholic. And from there, I went to Phoenixville, Pennsylvania, and got sober. Thank you very much for all of you.
Thank you. We have another one going to the mic, okay?
My name's Karen. I'm an alcoholic, and I love being sober. And my home group is the LaPorte Ladies Group out of LaPorte, Texas. And my question is, it's one thing, well, when you work with someone that is new, and then when you try to help someone that has had a length of sobriety, which unfortunately I have had knowledge of and worked with a couple that have had, one that has had 13 years and went back out, and another that has had a couple of years and went back out. And what I want to know is, in your experience with working with someone that has some time, do you do anything differently when you start to work with them again? Because it's not like they are a total newcomer. Anybody can answer that.
My experience dealing with folks who have been back out, most of the guys I've dealt with, when they came in, they didn't put a lot of time together to begin with. The few circumstances I've seen where folks had long-term, I kind of put them in the same group as folks who come to me who have got multiple years of sobriety and want me to sponsor them. It's okay, there must be a reason. What do you need? So we need to get into the book, and the book tells us very specifically what to do. So regardless of how long they have been here or how long they had been here, I always start at the very beginning, and I start with the book. And we're going to work the steps. That's the beginning. Mm-hmm. And doesn't matter how long you were sober before. It's not that all the time that you had before, it's not that what you learned is no good. You just quit doing it. So maybe now we need to go back and let's do it again. Let's go back through the steps, and let's figure out where you're at, and we can move from there. That's what I've done.
Thank you.
Okay, we have another one coming to the mic here.
I'm Tara. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Tara.
And I'm wondering if any of the speakers have experience working with members of the other gender, or if you prefer to subscribe to the men with men, women with women.
I will speak to that. I have had sponsees that were men, but they were gay men, and every time they had a man as a sponsor, they'd ended up in bed with them. Anyone else care to comment?
Hello, I'm Emma from Fairhaven Group, Bellingham, Washington. I'm an alcoholic. And I wanted to ask you whether any of you had experience 12-stepping your own, working with family members. I know that you're not meant to do it, My mother's an alcoholic, and I'm almost the only example of AA that she has in her life. And I don't know a great deal about AA. I'm new. But I was wondering whether any of you had experience with that and how you went about it. Thank you.
Did anyone want to comment on that? Okay. Thank you.
My name is David Chaffin. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you for your question. I do have some experience with this. I have a sister who self-proclaims to be alcoholic. And I also have a daughter who proclaims to be an alcoholic. One of the two semi comes to AA and the other one doesn't need AA. What my wife and I have done in both of those instances is we have turned those over to you. We've tried to be an example. We've tried to be the big book that if they're not going to read any other, we try to be a good big book for them to read. Beyond that, we're open to their questions. We answer any questions they may have. We let them see that the program works and that we're happy about it. But beyond that, we do not try to push AA on them or try to guide them or direct them as to what it is they need or should be doing.
Hi, my name is Gustavo. I'm from Holbox Island, Mexico. And I want to ask you, I've been working the 12th step. I have the opportunity in the jail, in institutions, as you said. And it's very good for my sobriety, I've been working. But now I live in an island of 2,000 people at the most, including kids and teenagers. And I don't have a chance for carrying the message to them. The people that have the problem, it looks like they have problems, of course. They don't accept it. And I tried many methods of talking to them, but it's very, very difficult. And it's a part of my recuperation that I need to do. I don't know if you have a suggestion. How can I get to them? I tried by the police, by the mayor, the medical center, but they don't respond to the things. If you have a suggestion, what can I do or what can I say? Or, I don't know.
I can be fairly brief with this. I also do work in the prisons, and I can tell you that often it's a frustrating process because I want to see results. Just like in my life, I want to feel good and I want things to happen. All I can tell you is that I do the same thing every time I walk into the prison. I do the same thing every time I walk into my home group. I do the same thing every time I step up to the podium to speak. I say, God, please give me the words that you would have me use. Help me to hear the things that you would have me hear. And I leave the results to him. And I know that it works. It works every time. And I don't have to worry about who gets fixed in this because I can only see a very small piece of this. It's just my job to do my job and let the rest work out.
We have time for one more question, and then we'll have to close.
Hi, I'm Pat. I'm an alcoholic. I'm from Memphis, Tennessee, really from Dallas, but I hang out in Memphis right now. And I have a sponsee who is very difficult to keep on track. She has about 3 years. She goes to, she went to a step study some of the time. And she comes to meetings pretty regularly, but when I try to get time to sit down and meet with her, she's of a different ethnic race, and she's afraid she's done so many things that are so much worse than what I've done that she really doesn't want to go through the fourth step. And so I say, you know, if we're not going to get together and meet this week, you got to get somebody else. And she says, okay, and then she doesn't call me for 4 days. So, I hate to drop her because I've put so much time in, and I know she respects me because I have some sobriety, but I cannot get her to get that step where she'll call and we'll sit and talk. So I don't know what to do with her. Thank you.
I just want to mention that the first step is I am powerless over alcohol. And that means them, too. That's something it took me a long time to learn, is that I have no control over anybody's recovery. All I can do is offer what I can offer. Anyone else want to comment?
I just want to answer it really quickly and also to say that we're staying sober when we do the 12 step, and that's the whole thing. We may not be able to get anybody else sober, but I'm staying sober. And also working with others in the big book really, really helps me to realize I'm not a nursemaid. I'm not a banker. If you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it. Took me a long time. I used to hear the silent scream inside my head when I would have people call me that weren't willing to go to any length. I don't fire sponsees today, but I give them a choice to do what I do, and you'll get what I get. And that's the way it works for me today. Thanks.
Thank you. I'd like to close with the Serenity Prayer for all those who wish to join us.